I'm going to be splitting my time a little here, talking about when to stop antibiotics, and then actually talk a little bit about going beyond surviving sepsis guidelines. What are we doing in refractory shock on the cutting edge? And those are going to be a little bit investigational, so I have nothing financial to disclose, but I will tell you when I'm talking about some investigational therapeutics. So the idea of source control is an old one, and one that we've known for quite some time as field physicians and surgeons. Indeed, surgical quality, in fact, if we think our M&Ms used to be bad, surgical quality has been also a significant concern of physicians in society for quite some time as well. So talking about the Surviving Sepsis Campaign, it's both in terms of source control and improving the outcomes of our patients, but also making sure that we provide the best high-quality care regardless of where the patient is and what sort of resources we have. In terms of talking about antibiotics, our starting point, or the starting point recommended by the Surviving Sepsis Campaign, is approximately 7 to 10 days, and these are supported by international and national guidelines as well. However, many of us, many of our septic shock sources that we will be dealing with are intra-abdominal. And actually, for source-controlled intra-abdominal infections, we actually want to be starting to use a shorter course of antimicrobial therapy. And I'll go over the data for that in just a second. Sometimes there are caveats and we need to extend our antimicrobial course, whether or not we have source control. Sometimes our patients have comorbidities, such as being immunosuppressed. And sometimes the bacteria itself that's causing the infection requires a longer treatment, as Dr. Zacherson discussed. So how are we able to shorten our antibiotic therapy for source-controlled intra-abdominal infections? So our moderators and their colleagues across the country actually published an article now 3 years ago about called the STOP-IT trial, looking at a short course of antimicrobial therapy for intra-abdominal infection. And what they found that 4 days of antibiotics, again, for source-controlled intra-abdominal infections is similar to a longer course. And what we've studied in the post-hoc analysis of this is that this is safe even when there are certain risk factors that predispose someone to more severe infections, such as diabetes or obesity. Regardless of the source control method, that's whether you do a laparotomy and leave a drain, laparotomy and close, percutaneous drainage, and even in severe illness, whether that's sepsis or Apache 2. With regard to sepsis, that was actually before the sepsis 3 guidelines came out, so the definition that was used for patients who were considered septic is a little bit outdated now already. But regardless, 4 days of antibiotics, almost regardless of the subgroup that was involved in this study, is safe. What's important, again, if I keep on reiterating it, is because this is incredibly important, particularly not just for us as surgeons to know, but also to share with our medical colleagues. If the STOP-IT trial taught me one thing, it's that source control is important. The antibiotics may be the icing on the cake, but if you do not have source control, we're not treating our infections. One important point to note is that one group that was minimally represented in the STOP-IT trial were immunosuppressed patients. And certainly there are some others that we deal with in the ICU or occasionally during our acute care surgery call that may also warrant longer antibiotics because the STOP-IT trial cannot be applied to them. So if we have one of those patients that we feel we're unable to safely stop the antibiotics at 4 days, what can we do? What should we decide other than a generic 7 to 10 days or 10 to 14 days? The reality is now we're sort of entering in an era of individualized antimicrobial therapy where we don't need to just use a guideline, but we can individualize that to the patient. And what procalcitonin has shown us is that we can safely shorten the antibiotic duration in the ICUs. I focused on ICUs, but there's several meta-analyses available and easily readable, PubMed and free access, open access, that have looked at it in respiratory infections, abdominal infections, pancreatitis. But for all comers coming to the ICU who are critically ill, our sickest patients in the hospital, we can safely use procalcitonin to not only shorten antibiotic duration, but also reduce mortality. In terms of using procalcitonin to diagnose sepsis and be able to implement that one-hour bundle, as Dr. Ho was talking about, as quickly as possible, the jury is still out. There's a lot of mixed results and non-significant results. But at least in terms of shortening antibiotics, procalcitonin is here. In terms of the future, where do we go from here? There are some ongoing trials right now that are recruiting or finalizing their protocols that are actually looking to even shorten the antibiotic duration even more. So for example, instead of the 4 days of the STOP-IT trial, they're now looking at 24 hours or 72 hours, where there's a couple studies looking at 48 hours of antimicrobial therapy once you've achieved adequate source control. In addition, there are studies that are looking at the use of procalcitonin in a prospective randomized trial and its utility in shortening the antibiotic duration. Now, to move on, like I said, to something a little bit different, I'm going to talk about, well, when we've done everything that we can do in the surviving sepsis guidelines and our patients are still in shock, and now we're faced with this idea of shortening the antibiotics, what do we have in our armamentarium that's a little bit on the edge, cutting edge? Now, these, again, I will say are investigational, but pretty remarkable, I think. The first is vitamin C. You may have heard about vitamin C from Paul Merrick and his colleagues over the last several years. Vitamin C has been studied in shock in the laboratory setting for quite some time. It's an antioxidant and thus has anti-inflammatory properties, possibly attenuating the exuberant inflammatory response that we see in septic shock. Vitamin C is also required to produce catecholamines in the adrenal gland. Finally, and this will make sense with the next slide, it's synergistic with thiamine and glucocorticoids. And one study has found recently that 100% of septic patients have low vitamin C levels. Now, of course, I don't know what the clinical significance of that is, and that study didn't look at it, but it's certainly notable. So in what limited clinical data there is, and I will admit an N of 146 is hardly practice-changing for most people except the most early adopters, there's still a significant and sustained large mortality effect for the use of vitamin C, with nearly no adverse effects. That protocol, there's a couple protocols that have been published, but I use the Merrick protocol, a lot of my colleagues use the Merrick protocol, is 1.5 grams of vitamin C for 4 days, again with the synergistic thiamine and hydrocortisone. Now, when we're starting vitamin C and the hydrocortisone, this is probably around the time that if you're following the surviving sepsis guidelines, you're starting the hydrocortisone anyway. So I don't recommend starting the hydrocortisone early or against the recommendations of the surviving sepsis guidelines, which have much stronger levels of evidence. But if you're already starting hydrocortisone, consider starting vitamin C and thiamine. There are 13 ongoing trials, including prospective blinded randomized trials, looking at this. And again, with the minimal side effect profile and the potential very large mortality benefit, it's something that I have decided to start early adopting. Many of my colleagues at University of Miami do as well. And we're anecdotally so far at least seeing good results and are going to be excited to see what these ongoing trials show. Next, there was a recent trial published called Athos 3 in New England Journal of Medicine, that was a year ago, about the use of angiotensin II as a vasopressor. Again, this is limited clinical data, this is one trial, but it showed that it improved MAPS in refractory shock, as well as cardiovascular SOFA scores at 48 hours. You basically start it as an infusion at 20 nanograms per kilogram per minute, and then titrate up over the course of 3 hours until you reach your MAP goal, maxing out at 200. Obviously, knowing the angiotensin effects on the human body and cardiovascular physiology, you do have to be cautious in patients with cardiac issues, cardiogenic shock, or STEMIs, for example. And again, this is limited data, but it is interesting to note that MAPS have improved. What will be coming next on the horizon here is looking at more clinically meaningful endpoints. Increasing your MAP for a couple hours certainly sounds nice, but what is that going to do in terms of actually treating your shock and helping you manage your patients? And finally, methylene blue. So methylene blue has been around for a long time in medicine, and even sometimes in different types of shock, like cardioplegic shock after cardiac bypass, liver transplantation sometimes uses it. But it's starting to be used in septic shock. I can't even put up a study there for you, really, because it's mostly case reports and case series. But I've personally found that in the last ditch effort, when I have nothing else to offer the patient and I find them dying in front of me on everything surviving sepsis and beyond, vitamin C, that methylene blue has been able to be of some utility. And I've been able to have a couple patients walk out of the hospital with the use of methylene blue. Again, plural of anecdote is not data, but something to consider for the early adopters. Methylene blue, it's the unknown mechanism right now of why it works in septic shock and continues to be studied. But the thought process is that we know for a fact that in septic shock, there's increased production of nitric oxide. And we also know from other animal studies that excessive nitric oxide leads to persistent vasodilation that may sometimes be refractory. To sort of simplify what methylene blue does on a physiologic and cellular level, it basically inhibits nitric oxide. So if we take all of those in order, it sort of makes sense to us why in refractory shock, methylene blue may be useful. Again, there's limited clinical data here, only two randomized control trials. The rest are case series or cohort studies. But a single bolus of methylene blue improved MAPS significantly for 2 to 3 hours. So what do you do after that 2 to 3 hours? It's still unknown whether or not a bolus or an infusion is better. I've gone more of the infusion route, but initially, your initial bolus, you want to give about 1 to 2 milligrams per kilogram over 10 to 15 minutes, and then either choose to bolus every 3 to 4 hours or start a low-rate infusion. There are other studies that have looked at higher doses, up to 4 milligrams and even higher, but you have diminishing returns after 2 milligrams per kilogram, where you start seeing increased complications related to pulmonary hypertension, cardiac issues, and increased incidence of serotonin syndrome. So again, to note, pulse oximetry becomes unreliable when you use methylene blue. It will turn the skin and urine blue, and despite the picture, it is temporary. Patients do recover their blue skin. It is contraindicated, absolutely contraindicated in patients with G6PD. And again, methylene blue does have some known pulmonary effects, increasing pulmonary vasoconstriction. So you have to be aware in pulmonary hypertension that will certainly exacerbate it, and in ARDS. Despite the pulse oximetry reading being unreliable, you still will drop your PaO2 over FiO2 ratio notably with the use of methylene blue. So patients with ARDS you have to use with extreme caution, particularly because this is still investigational. Thank you.